Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense.
And I'm Kimberly Adams. Thank you for joining us for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? And that means it's time for all of us to get just a tad bit smarter by the way of answering your questions.
If you've got one you would like us to find the answer to, or that we might happen to know the answer to, you know what to do. Email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org. Leave us a voicemail. Our number is 508-UB-SMART.
Okay, our first question today comes from Dale in North Carolina. He wants to know, why does the economy go into recession periodically? Is there a common cause, or is it just a common consequence of multiple causes? Over to you, Kai.
Yes, actually, to both of those questions. So
yes,
look,
first
of all, thank you very much for coming to my TED Talk. First of all, there is this thing called the business cycle, right? And it's a cycle for a reason. There are peaks and troughs. Troughs, obviously, are recessions. Peaks are the point at which a recession starts. So let me explain. And we're talking about this, obviously, because recession is on everybody's mind these days. Jay Powell was on Capitol Hill today. He'll be on Capitol Hill again tomorrow, where he will be asked and was asked today about inflation and gas prices and a recession and when's it coming and what's going on. Jay, please save us. So here's the deal. Okay, that last bit I extemporized.
Did you, though? Did you?
Well, not really, actually, because, the Senate Banking Committee basically today said, Jay, please save us.
Save us.
All right. So look, sometimes recessions just happen, right? Sometimes consumers and businesses just get a little about things. They start feeling not so good, maybe because gas prices edge a little bit higher or prices go up a little bit or something bad happens. And they say, you know
you
what?
You did that in such a New York accent. Oh my gosh.
I'm trying. and they start to pull back, right? Investors do, consumers do, businesses. And so you have a fall in what is called aggregate demand. And let's remember that just for argument's sake, give or take 70% of this entire economy is spending on behalf of or by consumers. So when consumers specifically start to feel a little squidgy about the economy and start to pull back, then businesses start to pull back because they're not going to make as much money. They don't order as many products. They aren't able to raise prices, all those things. And so the economy starts to slow down. Okay. That's the one main reason. Sometimes there's a crisis like, oh gosh, a pandemic or perhaps a war, right? And that actually pushes the economy as opposed to the economy just kind of tipping. But crises can push the economy into a recession, okay? And the last one is what may well be happening this time, which is that policy decisions, usually by the Federal Reserve, but not always, but policy decisions, specifically what to do about interest rates, which is, once again, the cost of money, what to do about interest rates helps push the economy into a recession. And why am I bringing that up? Well, it's pretty much universally agreed that Jay Powell and the Federal Reserve have been late in recognizing the sticking effects of inflation, right? Transitory was the word for a very long time. Now it's clear inflation sticking around. And there's a case to be made, and many have, that Powell and the Fed should have started raising interest rates earlier to push aggregate demand down. Remember that phrase from 2.5 minutes ago, right? And thus, perhaps cooled the economy a little bit before inflation got to 8.6%. So those are the three basic reasons. Now, super quick on the way out of this very long and winding answer. What is a recession? Well, a recession is not two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth. That used to be the sort of textbook definition of inflation. But there's a group of people.
Negative economic growth.
Negative economic growth. Sorry. Yes. Yeah. Thank you. There's a group of people at the National Bureau of Economic Research. It's called the Business Cycle Dating Committee. And they're the ones who get to decide. And what do they look at? They look at, and this is a quote, a significant decline in economic activity, right? Aggregate demand, that is spread across the economy, so not just one or two sectors, not just cars or houses, but widespread, and that lasts for several months. Here's the catch with this definition. We will not know we're in a recession this time or any time until basically it's over, until we have started pulling out of it. The NBER will note the peak of economic activity, the top, and then they will note the bottom, the trough. And once we start pulling out of that trough, once business picks up, once aggregate demand picks up, once financial conditions ease a little bit, then they will say, oh, look, we were in a recession from X period to Y period. And that's a very long answer, and I apologize for monopolizing the first 5 minutes of this podcast.
I'm very interested, and I actually want to circle back to something you said, like, half-ish way through all of that.
half-ish. Yes.
You were talking about what happens to consumer spending that can trigger recession and that consumers are, like, carrying the weight of the economy. Mm-hmm. We don't talk as often about business spending. How does what businesses are doing and how they're making their spending decisions factor into whether or not we move into a recession, which I understand we don't know until after.
Right.
But I understand quite a bit about, like, how consumer spending plays into, but what about business spending?
So there are a couple of main slices, main tranches of business spending that you gotta pay attention to. One is, and you hear this a lot, inventories, right? How well companies are managing that backlog of supplies that they have to sell to consumers. And you might have seen Walmart and Target both in the last, like, 3 weeks came out and said, holy cow, we way overbought inventory. We're getting clobbered, and we have too much stuff on the shelf.
Time to buy an air fryer.
That's exactly right, right? So that's a challenge. And now Target and Walmart are going to pull back, and they're not going to spend as much on inventories because they got a bunch of stuff sitting on the shelves, which, by the way, they're going to have to discount, right, and sell more cheaply, and thus their profit margins go away, so they might not be able to hire more people or give raises or what have you. So that's sort of one slice of it. The other slice is CapEx, right? Capital expenditures. The really big expenses that companies make on new equipment, new plants, those kinds of investments that will pay off, but in the future, right? I mean, if you're building a semiconductor plant, just to pick one that's reasonably in the news, that's like a 5-year investment, you know? And you're not going to spend $1 billion and it's going to pay off tomorrow. And so there's a lead and lag time that comes along with a lot of business spending that consumers, it's more immediate than businesses, really. There you go.
Okay.
All right.
Thank
okay.
you. That was
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Absolutely. Next question. Here we go.
Hey, this is Margaret from Okeechobee, Florida. And I wanted to see if you guys could make me smart on solar.
Oh, yeah.
So living in Florida and having all the gas issues and prices going up, I just don't understand why a state like Florida, the Sunshine State, doesn't do more with solar panels. Why aren't there solar panels on every house? We have so much sun, it feels like a waste. Thanks. Thank you, Mark.
Great question.
But how would those panels survive y'all's hurricanes is what I want to know. okay, so Kai, as you know, my family loves Disney World.
Yes.
And
yes.
I've been to Disney World more than once. And one of the things that always stands out to me about these multiple trips to Florida is how it'll be super sunny in the morning, random thunderstorm will roll in the afternoon, cloudy, rain, downpour, then sunny again in the evening. Okay. All of this to say that, yes, Florida has a lot of sun, but it's not actually as sunny as you might think. So the Florida Sun Sentinel, looked into this. This is a newspaper. And so one of the reasons that solar isn't more popular in Florida is, yes, Florida isn't as sunny as you think. It turns out that the states that actually have the biggest potential for solar energy tend to be a little bit more dry and not have, like, the daily deluge like Florida does. Arizona, New Mexico, parts of Southeast California, West Texas, places where there's not a lot of necessarily trees blocking the places where you might put the solar panels, and maybe not as much nuances in the weather, shall we say. And then the other part of the limits on solar panels in Florida is that the state itself prevents third-party solar power purchase agreements. Say that three times fast. Third-party solar power purchase agreements, which is basically nice. This idea that other people could buy the solar panels that sit on your house and you could work out some sort of deal. And this is a big roadblock. These agreements allow a developer to build solar on a home at little to no upfront cost for the homeowner. And the homeowner buys electricity from the developer, usually at rates lower than the utility rates. Sometimes you can feed that energy back to the grid for a certain amount of time. And then at the end of that time, the homeowner can either sign another agreement or end the agreement and remove the solar panels, purchase the solar system, whatever. And that's not so easy to do in Florida. And so solar energy advocates are trying to pass constitutional amendments in Florida that would actually allow these third-party purchasing agreements. I'm going to start saying that instead of Peter Piper picked a peck of pickle peppers.
Yeah, right. Oh, you did that well. Nice job.
Oh, thank you. It's almost like I work in broadcasting.
Oh, snap.
Okay, next up, we have a question about gas prices.
Hi, my name is Savannah, and I'm calling from Long Beach, California. I was just wondering, I saw a few posts on TikTok about a gas boycott, and I was wondering if something like this would work to lower prices, and at like what scale would the boycott need to be to work? And if something like this has ever been done before, please make me smart. Thank you.
Wow. So look, if you're going to boycott gas, you got to boycott gas and oil for a very, very, very long time. A one-day thing isn't going to do it. A two-day thing isn't going to do it. And look, I know last week we talked about, you know, what can consumers do to take care of inflation? And I said, stop buying anything that you don't necessarily need. That's kind of the answer here, right? A couple of points. Number one, oil and, oil specifically, right? Oil, once we get gas, is traded in a global market. So a boycott here isn't going to do much globally, right? We'd have to get like global oil consumers to stop, and then we might be able to keep up. And you saw, actually, there is a historical example, right? If we look at April 2020, I was out driving around just to kill time, actually, and the roads were empty. Wasting gas. But at that point, gas was like $70, you know, oil was $70 a barrel, so we had it to give away. And in point of fact, and thank you, Marissa, for pointing this out in the notes, if you remember, there was a crazy moment in late April, early May of 2020 when crude oil went negative, right? Where you actually had to pay somebody. You had to pay somebody $36 to take a barrel of oil off your hands. Right. It was cray cray. So that's the scale.
Wild.
Yeah, it was wild. And Stacey Vanek Smith, God love her. I mean, she used to be at Marketplace, and now she's at NPR doing the Indicator and Planet Money. She did a great piece on how can something that has an intrinsic value, right? A barrel of oil has an intrinsic value. How can that be negative? Anyway, that was a great piece. So that's the scale of boycott that we would need to make a dent in global oil and or gas consumption.
Just to put a pin on that, by the scale of global boycott, you mean shutting down the entire global economy,
I mean.
A la the first COVID shutdown.
Right.
That's the scale we're talking about to make a dent.
Exactly. And so this is not a thing like let's boycott Walmart because we don't like XYZ policy they have, or Apple because of the conditions at Foxconn in Shenzhen or anything like that, right? This is a global commodity, traded globally, used globally. That, oh, by the way, isn't just gas, right? If you think about oil, it's in plastics, it's in chemicals, it's in almost literally everything in this economy. And so just doing gas. It's in our bodies, it's in micro pellets, it's in all that stuff. So I admire the spirit, but the reality is really hard, truly hard.
Good question, though.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And look, I get the sentiment, right? Because you're like, oh, my God. Mm-hmm. But anyway, John in Texas, here's what he wants to know. How much of the low employment rate can be attributed to recruiting sites like LinkedIn and Indeed?
It is hard to say exactly what impact, if any, these sorts of job hunting sites have on the unemployment rate. But there was a study from the University of Pennsylvania where researchers found, surprisingly, that there's no evidence that online job searching tools have had an effect on overall U.S. joblessness. And that came from the Center for Equitable Growth as well. One of the explanations for that could be that while online job sites dramatically increase the number of job applications per listing, you know, it doesn't necessarily increase the number of jobs. It just may mean that it's if it's easier to apply for a job, you know, you can just upload your resume very quickly. But at the end of the day, they still need one person. And that ease of application sometimes creates mismatches between the open jobs and the job seekers. Glassdoor says that on average, each corporate job opening attracts 250 resumes.
Wow.
It's not.
That's crazy. Wow.
But how many of those resumes are like real?
True. That's fair. That's a good point. Yep.
Like, is this really a job that you want, or are you just like throwing spaghetti at the wall? Mm-hmm. You know? Which I have certainly done in job searches in the past. So increasingly, employers are starting to use algorithms and software to sort through these job applications to see like what's real and, you know, what may be a you know, nice academic researcher posting fake resumes to try and see if you're discriminating in your hiring process which also happens. So these sites are helping people, you know, land some new jobs, but they're also keeping, you know, job seekers out of the job market sometimes because those algorithms might weed them out if they don't quite know how to navigate them. Our wonderful colleague Megan McCarty-Carino, who covers workplace culture, says she's heard from experts who say that people are like passively getting job opportunities from sites like LinkedIn and Indeed with the idea that you don't necessarily have to be looking for a job for the job to come to you. And Kai, as popular as you are, I'm sure that you get LinkedIn messages all the time from people trying to lure you away.
Well, we'll save that for another podcast, shall we? Yes. Yeah. Anywho, let's do one more. We'll squeeze it in here. I kind of love this one. Here you go.
Hi, this is Robin calling from San Clemente, California. And my question is specifically for Kimberly. I really want to hear her top five tips for using bidders. Obviously, she's a fan, and I would like to learn how to integrate it. So please, make me smart.
I second that question.
Well, it's sort of like that hot sauce commercial. You know, you put that bleep on everything. Just put bidders in everything. So I have quite a few bidders. You know, there's the typical, I guess, how do you say it, Angostura bidders?
Yep. Those are the only ones I know, actually, Angostura bidders.
So that's the one you can get at the grocery store, and I tend to like put it into any kind of drink that I just want to be fancier. So if I'm drinking pomegranate juice, why not throw some bitters in it? Having ginger ale, sure, add some bitters.
You're going to get to it. What do bitters do?
It adds like, it fancifies the drink. It like tricks your brain, at least for me, into thinking you're having a cocktail, especially when you don't want to be like drinking, but you want to get that sort of cocktail-y flavor. To me, adding a dash of bitters into a non-alcoholic something really sort of like triggers that brain reaction. Where you're just like, it is 2:00 in the afternoon. I do not need to be having a cocktail, but I can have some pomegranate juice with bitters in it. And yes, I know that there is some alcohol content in bitters, but it's negligible.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a splash.
But the nice thing about sort of being here in DC, and I know in a lot of different places, there are all these like craft bitters. And so you can get like multi-packs of like bitters that cross all sorts of ranges. So I have like a 6-pack of bitters that have like smoke and habanero or grapefruit and rosemary or lavender and hibiscus or, you know, sea salt and coffee. And, you know, depending on what you put it in, sometimes you can taste a difference, sometimes not. Either way, you feel fancy. And then I have things like lavender bitters, which definitely have a stronger flavor to them. And so if I'm making a cocktail and I know I want to like add a little floral note to it, but I'm not going to like go and stick a flower in it and wait for it to steep for a couple of hours, I'll just put a couple of dashes of lavender bitters in and call it a day. And it makes me feel fancy. So
I learned something today.
That is how I handle bitters.
I learned something today. Awesome. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the question, Robin. I hope you have a wonderful journey with your bitters. And thank you all for joining us for the journey of the show today. That's all we've got. Thank you for listening. Kai and Amy Scott will be back tomorrow to hopefully make some sense of the news and make you smile.
In the meantime, you know what's next. Questions, comments, drink suggestions. We'll take anything. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Leave us a voicemail, 508-UB-SMART.
Yeah, how do we fancify your beers?
Yeah,
Make Me Smart is produced by Marissa Cabrera. Olivia Zhao is our new intern, although she's not so new. She's part of the team. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter.
Today's show was engineered by Juan Carlos Dorado. He's sitting there on the other side of the soundproof glass. Ramin Bentaladeh and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Our senior producer is Bridget Bondi.
Is it really soundproof, though? Like,
I don't know.
There's really loud.
There's an air gap in the middle, right? And then, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll ask somebody.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.